This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
In America's breadbasket, does the harvest of shame continue? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. It's been 40 years since Cesar Chavez made the plight of California's farm workers a national issue. But last month, four workers died from exposure to blistering heat in the fields of the Central Valley. Despite new laws and regulations, working conditions and living standards are being compared to John Steinbeck's 1939 novel, Grapes of Wrath. On To the Point, what's happened to the farm workers' union created by Chavez decades ago? Are generations of undocumented workers becoming a permanent underclass? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a major breakthrough in stem cell research. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Four farm workers recently died from exposure to blazing heat in California's Central Valley. On To the Point, what's happened to the farm workers' union started by Cesar Chavez? What's the role of illegal immigration? On Reporter's Notebook, pure brain cells created in Edinburgh and Milan may lead to cures for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's diseases. First, this news update. Officials in Massachusetts are considering mandatory mental health checks for National Guardsmen returning from Iraq. It's part of increased concern about post-traumatic stress disorder from exposure to life-threatening events, including combat and terrorism. Maria Kramer reports the story in today's Boston Globe. Maria, I understand that there was a program of this type in New Hampshire. The one in Massachusetts is modeled after it. Tell us how it works.
Sure. Basically, the program in New Hampshire is known as the Reverse Soldier Readiness Program. And it encompassed a wide variety of things, not just mandatory counseling sessions. What took place is around February or March, 800 National Guardsmen and women returned, and they went through a three-day process that included receiving dental exams, signing up for benefits, making sure their paperwork was in check. But one of the key components of it was this mandatory screening session. It took about an hour, and they sat down with a counselor who asked them a series of questions. And at the end of this, they were offered any kind of services. Turns out about 48% to be exact, did ask for some sort of follow-up, either a phone call, checking on later on to see if they were okay, or an actual appointment with a counselor at a vet center.
What's the importance of making this mandatory rather than voluntary?
Well, there are a couple of issues involved with making it mandatory. First, with National Guards, men and women, they are returning to civilian life, so therefore they are not going to be seen by their superiors as often as, say, an active duty officer. And this is a way of making sure that they upfront know what's available to them, as opposed to coming in later on when maybe it's almost too late, they've already started going through some symptoms. The other part of making this mandatory is it takes away from the stigma of going for a counseling session, because everybody's going through it, as opposed to a couple of people, and therefore there's none of that feeling of, there's Joe going in for services. So that was another part of making this mandatory.
So once again, the fact that the National Guards men and women are returning to civilian life right away does make them, or puts them, in a rather different category from the regular Army, the Marines, the Air Force, the other soldiers that we know about.
Correct.
Is there any effort to go beyond Massachusetts that you're aware of and do this on a national basis, or does it have to be state by state?
Well, I'm not quite sure about that, but I do know that the folks who are doing this, they're part of the Northeast Regional Office of the Veterans Administration Readjustment Counseling Services. It's a pretty long title. But they are looking at doing this in Vermont as well. And I do know that in New Hampshire, that the New Hampshire program has been getting a lot of national attention. So it is something that many mental health experts are beginning to see the value of. But at this point, they are working with National Guards folks in Massachusetts and possibly going to Vermont.
Talking with Maria Kramer, who's a reporter for the Boston Globe, I should tell our listeners that in Illinois, the governor has signed a bill requiring insurance companies in that state to cover treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. So there is a lot of new focus on this issue. But Maria, you're reporting that that's not the only thing that's turning up in these counseling sessions.
No, I mean, of course, post-traumatic stress syndrome is known as the extreme. This is the disorder, of course, that occurs at any time you witness a life-threatening experience. And it can happen, of course, in military combat, and it can also happen in situations like rape. But when the folks in New Hampshire were looking at doing the screening, they weren't just concerned about post-traumatic stress disorder. They were concerned about just, you know, the average transitioning of going back into daily life, such as, you know, being intimate with a spouse again, just going to the mall and not being alarmed by loud music. There's this sort of hyper of soldiers coming back are hypervigilant, of course. That's what they've been trained to do. But when they return, swaying bush along the sidewalk is very different in Lawrence, Massachusetts than it is in Iraq.
Lawrence, Massachusetts, of course, the place where a 33-year-old Marine sergeant fired a shotgun into a crowd of people outside his house. They were celebrating out there apparently very early in the morning. And I gather that post-traumatic stress disorder is one of the things that it's thought might have led him to do that.
Yes, this is correct. This is a highly respected Marine, only 33 years old. He was named Marine of the Year by the Marine Corps Times, honored by a U.S. Representative Martin Meehan. Really and seen as just a stalwart, strong soldier. And he came back, and it appears that something went terribly wrong. He had been seeking counseling for his war experiences, although I don't know the extent of it. But what seems to happen is that on early Saturday, a nightclub across the street that he had complained about often, you know, even before he went to war, there was a lot of loud noise, rowdiness, and someone threw a bottle through his window, breaking it. And at that point, he fired his gun, his shotgun, and the bullet unfortunately shattered and hit a couple of bystanders, including a 15-year-old girl and a 20-year-old man.
Obviously, one of the things that has led to great concern, and we'll hear more about this in the future, Maria Kramer of the Boston Globe. Thanks for being with us on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're Manali back with To the Point. Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is perpetually at odds with the Democrats who control California's state legislature, but they have come to agreement on one thing. After four farm workers died in the fields last month, there was bipartisan support for emergency regulations to require protection from blistering heat. Those incidents also cast new attention on the living and working conditions of the men and women who put the food on America's tables 40 years after Cesar Chavez made the plight of farm workers a national issue. Mark Cooper writes for the Liberal Nation magazine and the LA Weekly. He's also a host of Radio Nation. Mark, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
You have been in the fields recently. You've done some reporting on exactly the working conditions and living conditions that farm workers are undergoing at this point. How would you describe them?
Deplorable, in a word. As you mentioned, 40 years ago, Cesar Chavez and the UFW, the United Farm Workers, put the plight of these field workers on the map. No question that for a brief period in history, some very significant improvements were won thanks to both the work of the union and a responsive administration in Sacramento under Jerry Brown. But for the last 25 years, we've seen a pretty steady decline of those working conditions. So as of today, most of the people who work in the fields of California earn minimum wage. Some of them earn less. Their basic labor rights are routinely violated. And we have an industry now in California where the growers have shedded and eluded most of their legal and moral responsibilities by employing these workers through kind of shady and unscrupulous middleman contractors. So it is not a very pretty sight.
Describe in more detail, if you will, what you said earlier were deplorable working and living conditions. Let's talk first of all about the work situation. How is it that it's minimum wage or less? And what about hours worked? And how are labor rights violated?
Well, the immigrants who come to work in the California fields come from successively poorer and more marginal parts of Mexico. So we're finding poorer people, less educated people, and more vulnerable people in every sense who are coming to pick and pack our produce. What happens is that because a majority percentage of these folks are undocumented and don't have legal immigration status, the growers, the employers, skirt the law by not employing these people directly and therefore not assuming any responsibility in any way. They turn to kind of temp agencies. I mean, that's kind of a strange way of describing them. They're kind of fly-by-night contractors who go out and rustle up the workforce and sell that workforce in bulk to the employer. And then that middle person is the person who pays the workers. Often, he or she, as the case may be, this contractor will not pay minimum wage. They'll pay a lump sum that's less than minimum wage, or they'll cheat the workers out of a paycheck, or they'll short shrift them, because it's virtually impossible for the state of California, or at least the state is unwilling and unable, to enforce the law. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of farm workers, many of them not registered in any way legally, and then you have the contractors who are more than willing to exploit that situation. So it has become an industry that is, to a great degree, unregulated.
What about those farm workers who are, in fact, in the country on a permanent basis? What sort of living conditions, for example, do they have?
Well, you know, you find that one of the things that's happened, it's hard to make those distinctions. Clearly, there's some social mobility, and people who have legal documentation and have worked here long enough and have assimilated into the economy long enough, some of those farm workers can move upward, say, into construction and other jobs and establish some form of stable life. No question about that. But the vast majority of these people are now living in pockets of deep rural poverty throughout the Central Valley of California. It's a kind of economic and really an economic apartheid where people are crowded into apartments. They live sometimes in rusted out trailers that are rented for, exorbitant amounts of money, because there's very little infrastructure in the state to protect the rights of these people. The union, unfortunately, the UFW, has not been able to organize or represent a significant portion of these workers. And other agencies like the California Rural League Assistance, who's a nonprofit agency that's dedicated to aiding these workers, by law they can't, for example, they can't deal with anybody who's undocumented, so that immediately eliminates half or more of the workforce. So there's kind of a devil's bargain that's taking place. We have, by world standards, really cheap produce. I mean, we can buy lettuce and tomatoes at pretty low prices in our supermarkets, and one of the reasons we can do that is that we, as a society, have decided to pay our farm workers very little money and not really care about the conditions they're in.
Mark Cooper, once again with The Nation Magazine, the LA Weekly, and Radio Nation on public radio. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
One of the major figures in organizing the farm workers more than 40 years ago is Dolores Huerta. She was co-founder of the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez. She now runs the Dolores Huerta Foundation and focuses on community organizing and leadership training. Ms. Huerta, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, just fine. Thank you for inviting me.
Is what we heard from Mark Cooper, in your opinion, an accurate description of what's going on?
Well, yes, it is to a great degree. I mean, there's very little enforcement right now. All of these great laws that the United Farm Workers was able to pass in the legislature, such as workers need to have a 10-minute break every 4 hours, that workers should not work in conditions that endanger their health and safety, which is, of course, the conditions that workers were working under when they died of these heat strokes. All of these laws are just not being enforced. And Governor Schwarzenegger actually cut the budget of enforcement of any of the labor laws, especially in the fields, by quite a lot. And so this is, of course, then what this is a situation that has and that we now see is where these workers do not have not even the protections of the law. Many of the workers, as Mr. Cooper reported in his article, are not getting minimum wage the way that they should. You know, because they are undocumented, the labor contractors pretty much pay them what they want. I think the only workers that really have the protections of the promise of Cesar Chavez is those workers that are working under union contracts. And, of course, those workers not only are the laws enforced, but they are able to negotiate their wages. They have a health plan named after Robert Kennedy, which not only covers the worker but the entire family. They have a pension plan so that when they retire from working, they will have an income in addition to their minimal Social Security that they can live. Unfortunately, we know that the United Farm Workers has had a very, very hard struggle. We had 16 years of Republican governors. And Governor Davis, in the short time that he was in office, you know, had to undo so many of the errors of the Republican administrations against workers. And he did, as we know, sign one very important bill for the farm workers, that when the workers do win an election, that the state can come in through the mediation process and help them get a first contract. But we know that there's still an awful lot of work to do, but unfortunately the resistance of the growers is as bad as it was before. And so many of the workers, as was said in Mr. Cooper's article, are undocumented. But one thing we do want to make very clear is that the Farm Workers Union has always been the largest organization of undocumented workers from day one. And the United Farm Workers, we are the ones that fought for the legalization of 1,400,000 farm workers in 1984-85 when the Immigration Reform Act was passed. And that push was directly by the United Farm Workers. It was spearheaded by Congressman Howard Berman. Peter Rodino was then known as the Rodino Bill, but it was because of United Farm Workers' constant advocating for undocumented workers that workers have been able to get some kind of relief. And the United Farm Workers, of course, still continues to be the advocate for undocumented workers with the bills that they are now fighting in the U.S. Congress.
My understanding is that the number or the percentage of farm workers now organized by the union is down to 2 or 3% from what it was before, maybe 5,000 or so, as opposed to 75 or 80,000 in the past. How do you account for that?
Well, you know, I'm going to let I understand that Mark Grossman is going to be also on this call and see, and he is representing the United Farm Workers in this instance, and so I will let him respond to that. But, you know, one of the things that I do want to point out, too, for those folks that read Mark Cooper's article in the LA Weekly, is that the reason that the Farm Workers Union went down from 100,000 workers to 20,000 workers or 30,000 is because we had this big fight with the Teamsters in 1973 when they came in and signed sweetheart agreements with the growers. And then we had to start all over again after the Agricultural Labor Relations Law was passed, and then we had these 16 years of Republican governors. So, you know, the United Farm Workers is to this day still playing catch-up and doing a very good job of it under the leadership of Arturo Rodriguez. The other thing I want to point out, too, is that, you know, the farm workers' boycott that we had in the 80s was against pesticides. That boycott was because of all of these farm worker children that were dying of pesticides and the farm workers that were getting cancers and also dying. And that's what that great boycott was all about.
You mentioned Governor Schwarzenegger earlier. Didn't he sign the bill, which the growers were opposed to, that would provide some sort of protection against what's referred to as pesticide drift, which has been so devastating to the health of farm workers?
Yeah, yes, he did. But again, with that bill, and this is just my personal opinion, that anything that comes out of Sacramento or even Washington for that matter, if we don't have proper enforcement, then it's just paper. It's just paper. And one of these issues about the farm workers that have been dying in the fields, you know, in the Imperial Valley of California, where the temperatures go up very high, and in the Yuma area, say of Arizona, where you have a lot of farm work, people do not work when it gets hot. You know, the growers are very, very careful to make sure that the sugar and the grapes is of a certain content before it can be shipped. Well, they need to be equally careful about the farm workers. When the temperature gets up to a certain degree where workers' lives are being endangered, then they need to be taken out of the field. And that is a very, very simple way to keep farm workers from dying.
Once again, Dolores Huerta, one of the founders of the United Farm Workers Union, and now with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. We will, as she indicated, have a representative from the union in just a moment. First, though, I want to go to a representative from the growers. Manuel Cunha is president of the Nisei Farmers League, which represents some of the growers. He himself is a citrus grower. And, Mr. Cunha, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Let me ask you to respond first, if you will, to the question that Mark Krueper raised earlier about what he referred to as the outsourcing or indirect hiring of workers by growers who basically, in his opinion, shift their responsibilities, both legal and moral, onto these middlemen, these labor contractors who actually then deal with the workers. What's your version of that?
Well, Mr. Cooper doesn't understand the economics of agriculture, doesn't even understand the proper terminology to classify them as temps. Farm labor contractors in this state go through the most stringent regulations than any other state. Most other states, they only have to file with the federal government. California requires a state farm labor contractor license him. And over the past 4 years, the contractors now have to go to an 8-hour class yearly that teaches and gives them on pesticide safety, worker safety, internal revenue, wage and hour issues, OSHA safety, all of those. No one else in the country does that. We have about 1,200 farm labor contractors registered in this state, a big improvement over anywhere else in the country. Secondly, these contractors have to submit, under law today, a certified workers' comp certificate, liability, the contractor's bond, and everything must go to the grower. And every week must submit a bona fide payroll record that shows the names, the wages, the tie, Social Security number, everything that one would imagine is more stringent than any other business today. So contractors are important to agriculture, especially the small farmer, in which a farm worker will not go to a small farmer when he needs them to only work for a week. If it's picking strawberries, if it's picking tree fruit, or if it's picking vegetables or even raisins. And it's logical. Why would a worker try to find 20 different growers to work for when he can go to a good legal farm labor contractor and have employment for 8, 9 months, 7 months out of the year?
Dolores Huerta made the comment a moment ago that the rules and regulations are fine if they're enforced. She says if you don't enforce them, they're only paper. What about this? And did the governor, in fact, Governor Schwarzenegger, cut back the enforcement ability of the state?
In her response, regulations have been implemented and are enforced. Many of my growers that I weekly work with are receiving a notice of a violation, or that this information came to them in the mail. Is this what we need to do today? Do we got to start implementing this? The regulations are being enforced, and as far as Governor Schwarzenegger did, he changed a policy within the agency to streamline and do a better job of enforcement in all industries, not just focusing on agriculture.
Okay.
But agriculture has a darn good record over the past years of more compliance than many other industries out there today, because there has been a heavy increase in enforcement from the field sanitation side.
We're going to take a break. Mr. Cunha, I'm going to interrupt you. We are coming back. We will hear more from him. We'll hear from the Farm Workers Union as well, and more from Dolores Huerta. We'll also talk about illegal immigration. On Reporter's Notebook, a major breakthrough in stem cell research. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about conditions, working conditions, living conditions for farm workers in the breadbasket of the United States, the Central Valley of California. 40 years after the formation of the United Farm Workers Union by Cesar Chavez, and one of our guests today, Dolores Huerta, now with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. We're talking right now with Manuel Cunha, who's president of the Nisei Farmers League, which represent growers. He himself, again, is a citrus grower. Again, back to the question of the indirect employment of the workers. presuming that what you say is correct about the contractors, the middlemen, why don't growers employ workers directly, number one? And number two, what about immigration forms? Do they have to check and see if, in fact, the workers that the contractors are employing are in the country legally?
First question is, the reason small employers and many other employers in California cannot hire labor directly is because it's too seasonal. A grape grower that's growing raisins only needs workers for the pruning time, which could be 1 week, and the harvesting could be 1 week, and that's the end. So that worker must then go find other jobs. Very difficult. So the farm labor contractor acts and is the employer and does the requirements of safety training, et cetera, et cetera. So the big issue for many growers is they cannot afford to hire labor because of workers' comp is out of touch for a small grower. He might as well mortgage the farm because the rates are so bad. Even today with the discounted rates, they're still out of proportion, and many businesses across the state are suffered because of the ineptness of workers' comp.
What about the question of immigration?
The issue of immigration is real simple. You cannot question another employer's employees, because if you do that, then you get into joint employer liability problems that's set forth in Congress under the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. But those contractors that do hire labor, just like any other employer, you only have the tools to check those individuals under law that says you look at the document for its validity on its face value. To go any further than that, under the Department of Justice, you're sued for discrimination. So there's a catch-22 in this law that was developed in 1986 under Immigration Reform and Control Act that became law in 87 of May.
Okay, Manuel Cunha, again, president of the Nisei Farmers League. As promised, remember, a spokesperson for the United Farm Workers has been the spokesperson for the United Farm Workers since Cesar Chavez's day. He's Mark Grossman. And Mr. Grossman, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Let me get you to respond to what we just heard directly ago by Manuel Cunha with regard to the hiring by the independent labor contractors. What's your position on that?
Well, Mr. Cunha is partly correct in when he describes what the law says, but it doesn't really reflect the fact that although California has some of the toughest laws in the nation protecting farm workers, most of them are not enforced. Farm labor contractors may be stringently regulated on paper, but many, perhaps half of them, are unregistered fly-by-night operators. And, you know, too often it's not really the farm labor contractor's fault entirely, because many growers don't put enough money on the table in order for the contractors to obey state and federal laws. Contractors put out to bid their jobs, and the lowest bid gets the job, and many times that bid is below what it takes to pay the minimum wage, to provide unemployment insurance, to pay state and federal taxes, to obey the host of other laws that have been on the books for years to protect farm workers. The agricultural industry, you know, Mr. Cunha says, has a great record when it comes to compliance. But just to give you an example, when it comes to field sanitation, these are the laws and regulations requiring toilets and clean, cool drinking water in the fields. Well, the state of California only makes a couple of hundred inspections every year of farms to check for compliance with field sanitation laws. Well, with tens of thousands of farms in California at that rate, it would take the state of California about 250 years to inspect every farm once. So the record of enforcement, unfortunately, under both Democratic and Republican administrations, has really been a disgrace.
Before you go on, who's supposed to provide the field sanitation? The
employer,
the grower, or the labor contractor?
Both. Well, it depends on who's hiring the workers. If the farm labor contractor is the employer, it would be the contractor. If the grower is hiring directly, it would be the grower.
How is there a difference in compliance between the two?
Many farm workers will say that they'd rather work for the worst grower than the best farm labor contractor. Too often, a lot of the horror stories you hear are workers being mistreated at the hands of labor contractors.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to Manuel Cunha. What about what we heard just now about the fact that the contractors have to bid, the lowest competitive bid wins, consequently they don't bid enough to pay the farm workers what they are entitled to, and the farm workers, many of whom are illegal immigrants, don't have any place to appeal to?
Well, I think in regards to what Mr. Grossman just stated is that the amount of inspections that go on in agriculture are greater than any other industry in this state. Agricultural farms and farm labor contractors get quite a few inspections across the board.
Well, whether you compare them to other industries or not, though, if there are only 200 or so a year and there are tens of thousands of farms, is that really doing the job?
Yes, it is, because they are doing the jobs where they know and they have had complaints, or where they do what they call the TIPS program, where they go out and do random selections and find farms that are doing a good job. So there's no reason to cite those farms. Whereas as a bad farmer or a bad farm labor contractor, they will cite them, and I know they've done the job. I've seen them, and I've seen bad contractors go down, and we have seen bad contractors in areas where violated worker rights have been really hit with penalties and have been taken their license away. But going back to the issue of farm labor contractors in this state, it's real easy. If you want to make growers hire all the labor, then they'll all go to mechanization because that farmer cannot afford and the worker will not work for a farmer for more than a week. And so you've taken away those jobs. They're gone then, because if you solely put it back to the grower, he cannot afford to work, to hire workers for a week because of the stringent requirements upon the workers' compensation and all those other things. And a farm worker, and I've talked to many farm workers, that they want to work more than a week. They want to work for 4, 5, or 6 months and then go back home.
Okay, Manuel Cunha, once again with the Nisei Farmers League. I want to raise again the question of organization. Dolores Huerta mentioned a moment ago that whereas at one time there might have been 100,000 people in the union, there are now about 20,000. Other people use different figures, say it's 75 or 80,000 in the past, maybe 5 or 6,000 now. In any case, considerably fewer and a lower percentage by far than there were in the 1970s. Mark Grossman, back to you with the United Farm Workers. How do you account for that?
Well, Mr. Cooper never asked the United Farm Workers about any of the accusations he made in his story. So it is riddled with lies.
Our listeners haven't read his story. I'm asking what Dolores Huerta said, that
it's very
there has
simple.
Been a big reduction.
Unions must file yearly reports with the U.S. Department of Labor that list their finances and their membership, among other things. The bureaucrats at the U.S. Department of Labor have instructed us for years that a union determines the number of members it has under contract as of December 31st of every year, the end of the fiscal year. And unfortunately, in agriculture, there are not a lot of farm workers working in the fields at the dead of winter. So we have repeatedly told the Department of Labor that does not accurately reflect our membership, and they've instructed us to fill out the forms as instructed, and we have. And that's what Mr. Cooper is relying upon. But had he asked us about it, we would have been able to explain that, but he didn't.
Well, what about Dolores Huerta, who says 100,000 one time, 20,000 now? Let's take those numbers. How would you, if they're accurate, how would you explain that? Why has there been that reduction?
Well, because we had perhaps 80,000 in the early 70s when the Teamsters were handed the UFW's contracts. In 73, we lost nearly all of our contracts, started to regain them in 75 when the farm labor law was passed and farm workers had the right to vote in union elections. Membership rose up into the 40,000 range until George Dumajian took office in 83, and under 16 years of Republican governors, we lost more than half the membership. It went down perhaps to 20,000. At the time of Caesar's passing in 93. Since then, Arturo Rodriguez, the UFW president, kicked off a new organizing campaign. We've won elections, negotiated contracts. Membership is up to about 27,000 now, mostly in California, but also in three other states.
Why are Republican governors responsible for the ability of the union to organize?
Well, because the landmark historic Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which we won in 1975 under Jerry Brown, granted farm workers for the first time these rights to organize and bargain with their employers. I think that neutral observers today will admit that under the two Republican governors, enforcement of that law was shut down. Many growers whose contracts came up for renewal refused to renegotiate them. Others engaged in corporate reshuffling, shutting down operations and popping up the next day as a new company. Thousands of farm workers were fired, blacklisted. Some of them were beaten up, and two of them were murdered. So that's why.
Mr. Cunha, back to you with the Nisei Farmers League. How do you react to that description of what happened under two Republican governors, George Dumajian and Pete Wilson? And I should add, Gray Davis was mentioned a little earlier as well. He, of course, was a Democrat, recently unseated by Arnold Schwarzenegger. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I cannot Mr. Mark Cooper, of course, never did call us either to ask us about the
Okay, again, he's gone. We're not arguing about his article, but rather about what Mr. Grossman just said.
I can call him whatever. You know what I mean? I can just take what the information I've had. But in response to Mr. Grossman's comments about the union's activities, I think that there's been a lot that's been credited to agriculture and the UFW trying to resolve problems across the country, but especially in California, I think over the past years, has nothing to really do, I think, with Republicans or Democrats and the issue of governors. But what it does have is that there has been always a litany of legislation that requires both sides to come to some type of an agreement on an issue that may be brought up by either agriculture or even by the UFW. And I think many of those things are happening, and that helps to, I think, say that things are happening and farm workers don't believe they need to join the UFW or the union because of the things that are happening. I think that's an issue that is really real, and I think that's where memberships are dropping, just like with any ag groups across the country, is if things are happening and stuff, a farmer won't join an ag group because things are going along well.
Okay. Obviously, we're not going to reach agreement here between labor and management, and we never expected that we would. But there is, however, some concerted effort on both parts, I believe, to deal with the question of illegal immigration. And Dolores Huerta, I want to go back to you on this one with the United Farm Workers. Cesar Chavez was opposed to illegal immigration. You said in the later days of the union, though, that it had attempted to organize illegal immigrants. What do you think is, and what is the, I believe the union agrees with you on this, I think is the best solution now for this question of illegal immigration in the farms?
Well, first of all, the union was never against undocumented people. I mean, all of our service programs, we, Cesar and I first started the union by helping people get their immigration status. Way back in 1962, that was one of our big service programs that we had. We actually helped entire towns immigrate to the United States. So the union has never been anti-undocumented immigrants, never in the history of the United Farm Workers. And when we did pass the SAW program, the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program, which the United Farm Workers is the one that passed that program that got legalization status for 1,400,000 farm workers.
Okay, well, excuse me if I misstated the case. So what do you think ought to be done now?
Well, I think what the union is doing now is supporting the Ag Jobs Bill, again, to get another legalization program for the farm workers that are now working in our fields. And also, of course, there's also the McCain-Kennedy Bill, which also has a provision in there for legalization. And I think that this is the only way that you're going to be able to solve the issues. Of course, the other way is, of course, having a union. Because when the United Farm Workers gets a contract, it covers all of the workers that are working in that company, whether they're legal or undocumented. I mean, they are all covered under the contract, and they have the same benefits and the same representation as all workers do. And I just want to add one more thing. But Mr. Kling, I cannot let that pass. The United Farm Workers, in their elections that they have had since the law was passed, 200,000 farm workers have voted for union representation. 200, it's probably more than that now. I mean, this is the figure 5 years ago when Governor Davis signed the mediation bill. So this idea that the workers don't want to join the union is just false.
Okay.
I mean, unfortunately, we still have this attitude from the growers that they're going to fight unionization no matter how.
Very quickly, I want to follow up on this idea of the kind of legalization that you're talking about with the Ag Jobs Bill and the McCain-Kennedy Bill with Stephen Camerota. He's director of research for the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, a think tank that considers this subject. And, Mr. Camerota, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me on.
You're opposed to this, as I understand it, in the as applied to agriculture and elsewhere. Explain why.
Well, look. It's basic economics. If you increase the supply of something, in this case agricultural labor, you naturally lower its price. And the price of agricultural labor is wages, benefits, and working conditions. If you want to improve the lives of people who do farm work, then the solution is to just import fewer farm workers. This will force businesses to pay more, it will treat workers better, it will transfer bargaining power to the employee, and in turn, it will also cause greater mechanization, which would be a very good deal for taxpayers, because bringing in lots of unskilled workers generally socks the taxpayers with a big bill, because unskilled workers generally pay very little in taxes. and use a lot in services. So a much lower level of immigration would be extraordinarily helpful to the wages and benefits and working conditions of American workers, including those in agriculture.
Okay. Mark Grossman, back to you. United Farm Workers, what do you say to that analysis?
Well, it's just not a reflection of reality. The fact is that we have, according to federal stats, the majority of the farm labor workforce in California now is undocumented. It's the overwhelming majority in certain crops and areas. Those people are here now. They're not going away. And the only equitable solution is to allow them the opportunity to earn, we call it hard-earned legalization, to earn the legal right to stay here by continuing to work in agriculture, to submit themselves to national security checks, criminal background checks, to ensure they don't have a felony record or that they're not a terrorist, and then to allow them to continue working in this country.
Okay, Mr. Camerota, they're here. Why not then, as Mr. Grossman suggests and as the bills, as I understand it, provide, allow them the opportunity to earn legalization, get their status and their clout that way?
Well, beyond the fact that you're obviously rewarding illegal behavior by taking people who are willfully and knowingly violating U.S. law and rewarding them with one of the greatest benefits in the world, that is U.S. permanent residence and eventual citizenship. But beyond that problem, and beyond the fact that it slaps in the face all the legal immigrants who actually wait their turn to come to America if we give legal status to people who jump in line and just come illegally, but beyond those two things, it's still a bad deal for California because what you end up with is a much larger poverty population. For example, the issue of raisin farming came up. Now, Australia has very internationally competitive raisin farming, but what they've done is not bring in a whole lot of workers to work very short periods of time. What they've done is mechanized. They've moved to what's called dried-on-the-vine agriculture. The reason they did that, they didn't have a lot of labor to use, so they just mechanized, something the United States is generally very good at. But if we keep the current paradigm in place, we legalize the illegal aliens instead of enforcing the law and making them go home, we'll continue to have a relatively unproductive sector where work is very intense for a short period of time, and where you get a lot of what you're basically doing is transferring the rural poverty of Mexico to rural California.
Okay, Dolores Huerta, back to you. What about that argument that we're transferring poverty, rural poverty, from one country to another, and that it's a real slap to those people who wait in line to become legal under the usual arrangements?
Well, first of all, these are very productive people, not only in the fields, but in our restaurants and our hotels and in our janitors in our buildings and as caretakers for our people who are disabled and our children. So these are not people that are not being productive. They are holding up a very, very big chunk of the economy of the United States of America. And there is no reason for them to remain in poverty. Obviously, that if when the farm workers are under a union contract, they contribute to taxes, they contribute to the society, they contribute to the local economy. So there is no reason for people to have to remain in poverty.
Quickly, Manuel Cunyan, I'm sorry to cut you off, Ms. Huerta, but we're running out of time. I want to get the Nisei Farmers League response on this one. Are you supportive of the same legislation that the farm workers are supporting?
Yes, I think Arturo Rodriguez worked his hard work with agriculture to come up with this bill, and he's worked a long time on this thing, more than we've had it at 5 years, altogether 7 years. But I got to give the efforts to Arturo Rodriguez. He did work hard with agriculture.
President now of the United Farm Workers Union.
Yeah.
Why are you supportive, given the arguments of Steve Camerota, who says we might have a more efficient, better functioning agricultural industry?
No, I think we know what the industry is. The other gentleman who has made comments about Australia doesn't understand the industry of economics, even in California with the raisin industry, to go dried on the vine, very expensive process. You eliminate a lot of workers, and there are family farmers who cannot afford to build that, so they rely on the workforce that's here. And those workers that are here deserve a right to become a resident alien. And then under the Ag Jobs Bill, it's you have to earn the right to stay and work in this country. And it's for 5 to 6 years, and then you have a right to go to residency. And I know that Mark Grossman has worked hard on this with the UFW.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry we are out of time. Stephen Camerota didn't give you a lot of time, had a lot of people on this program. We'll come back, talk about this immigration bills on future programs. Meantime, thanks to all of you for being with us. Manuel Cunha of the Nisei Farmers League, Steve Camerota, again, Center for Immigration Studies, Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, Mark Grossman, spokesperson for the union, and our earlier guest, Mark Cooper, with The Nation, the LA Weekly, and Radio Nation. discussion on the public radio. Scientists in Scotland and Italy are claiming a major advance in stem cell research. They say it could put them on the way toward eventual treatment of diseases including Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. For the first time, scientists have been able to grow and sustain pure brain cells. The breakthrough was accomplished at labs in Edinburgh and Milan. Dr. Peter Mountford is CEO of Stem Cell Sciences. That's a publicly traded company in London, which has exclusive rights to commercialize the research that we're talking about today. Dr. Mountford, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
What is the nature of the breakthrough, as it's been described, in Edinburgh and Milan?
The real essence of this is the ability to grow these cells properly, robustly in a laboratory, in a highly purified form. Until recently, until this publication, that just simply hasn't been possible for tissue stem cells as we know them.
When you say grow cells, we're not talking about cloning here.
No, we're talking about just producing enough of the cells to use them in medically relevant ways. Previously, we've been able to extract a small number of cells and propagate them somewhat as mixtures of cells, but when you have a mixture of cells, it's very limited in its application. The industrial or the medical application is very much dependent upon being able to grow enough cells in a highly purified form, and that's what this discovery is all about.
What does purified mean in this context?
It means that each cell in the dish is the same as the other cell, so each cell will perform in a predictable way, rather than being, for example, a cell which might be relevant for Alzheimer's disease or a cell which might be relevant to Parkinson's disease. These cells are all of the same.
Now, they're talked about as brain cells and as nerve cells. Is there a difference?
The brain consists of the majority of nerve cells, but these cells are stem cells, which is the important part. And a stem cell of this type is capable of producing all of the nerve cells present in the brain. So it's, if you like, primitive nature is very valuable in that it creates a diversity of cell types which we can work with going forward.
What, then, is the most immediate application of this research?
The most immediate application is already underway. It's enormously valuable to academia in the first point, which is really where the cutting-edge research is always done. This is a discovery that was made a little while ago. Of course, it takes a while to get published, but already its application in developing different types of brain cells is progressing very well within academia, and our colleagues in Italy have been very successful in that regard. The next application is to now take that into commercially relevant fields.
So what would those be? What would you expect first?
The stem cells are frequently, one of the major applications for stem cell, which is frequently overlooked, is to use the cells, the stem cells themselves, and the different types of nerve cells that they produce, to discover, develop, and test new drugs. So by growing, if you like, what we call a biomass, a large volume of different types of nerve cells, we can study specific diseases or we can test drugs to either block the onset of a disease, block the progression of a disease, or potentially even put a disease into remission. And so it's the application for the pharmaceutical industry, which is really potentially the greatest value of these cells.
So I gather then what you're saying is that you can do something you could never do with a human being who had the disease. You can actually create it and then do laboratory tests on what works to control it and what doesn't.
That's right. In fact, because these cells represent a very early cell, you can actually study the onset and progression of a disease, which, you know, if you look at it in its crude form, you would have to be sampling some poor patient's brain every few months or so to see how they're progressing, which, of course, is completely out of the question. So it opens up all sorts of research opportunities that were previously unavailable.
How soon do you think there might be drugs developed that could treat Parkinson's or Alzheimer's?
There are drugs on the market that treat symptoms. In some instances, it simply won't be possible to treat people who are already suffering Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease with drugs, because the cells that they need to function normally are already gone, and that's really where the long-term application of these cells may rest in replacing diseased or damaged tissues. But to develop drugs which block the onset or the progression of the disease, we already have been approached by the pharmaceutical industry and a number of biotech companies wishing to access this technology to use it in their drug discovery programs. And so we expect this technology to be transferred quickly into the pharma industry, where it will have immediate application and immediate value.
Once again, Dr. Peter Mountford, CEO of Stem Cell Sciences, has the exclusive rights to commercialize the research being done in Edinburgh and Milan. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're more than welcome.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Jonah King and Christian Bordahl, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.